Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
What's up, guys? Dan here with Elkshape. Today, we are bringing on Dr. Gillette. This is the podcast I talked about a month ago, and it's here today. So I'm going to sit down and basically advertise and let you guys find out what my blood work is and what steps I'm going to take. But the cool thing is I also had my wife's blood work done. So if you are married, I want you to get your spouse to listen to this, because we're going to spend at least half the time going over her blood work. Alicia is a former track athlete. She's the fittest woman I know in my whole world. And she's a gifted athlete, trains hard, and is very active. So we'll have her on here as well. Oh, she's here right now. Hi.
Hello.
Mrs. Elkshape, how are you?
Doing good. It was so interesting to go over these labs with Dr. Gillette today. I learned a lot, and it's crazy how even when you feel really vibrant and like you're taking all of the right steps towards good health, that there are still a number of things that we need to look at to deep dive in on and find out where we can improve. And sometimes it seems like it just is could be a simple thing.
Yeah, guys. So, like, Doc's going to come on here, and it was a little bit of a flashback to me because I've already had my real consultation after I had my blood work. And I remember leaving that meeting going, okay, 90% of what he said went over my head, but 10% stuck. And he gave me actionable steps to improve my overall footprint of health and well-being and longevity and trajectory. And that is the part that I'm worried about. The listeners today are going to hear him break some stuff down, and they're going to be like, I don't even know what he's talking about. So at the end of this podcast, Alicia and I are going to come back on, and we're going to dumb it down as to our takeaways and then encourage you to do this for yourself and kind of get the formula of, you know, where are the chinks in your armor and how can you mitigate them? And that's really the bottom line. So at the end of this podcast, guys, relax. Some of this is going to go over your head. Some of this goes over our head. It's okay. We're going to dumb it down at the very end. So stay tuned to the very end. Without further ado, this is Dr. Gillette, and you're listening to the Elkshape Podcast. Today's podcast is brought to you by Matthews Incorporated out of Sparta, Wisconsin. I love shooting to Matthews. I love the engineering, the technology, the people behind the brand. It's like the bows are amazing, and I would encourage you to go to a local dealer and try one out for yourself.
Good morning.
Hi.
Look at that background.
Clean.
Yeah, it's pretty plain.
Nice. How was your weekend?
Pretty good. I did a competition and we had lots of fun. So, not too sore. Other than the bruises I got from a surprise heavy kettlebell clean event.
Right here?
Maybe up here? Oh, yeah.
They're already kind of healing some, but yeah, here, here, here. Yep.
I know all about that.
How are you guys?
We're good.
Yeah, man.
Excited to go over my labs.
She's so excited. No, she got her results back and hasn't been off the Google search engine looking up everything, freaking out. And I'm like, just wait for the doc. We'll go through it. But before we get started, man, let's just dive right in. I know your time's busy and I know I have a bunch of stuff after this. So give the audience like a quick little background on you and kind of what you do, your forte, if you will.
Yeah, so I'm an MD and I'm board certified in family medicine and obesity medicine. My forte, I guess, is what I call individualized medicine. So you take three different circles. You take evidence-based medicine, what we know is good science, high-quality evidence. And then you take the patient's goals, and you're meeting those in a Venn diagram. And then you're taking all options of what you could reasonably do. With most things, there's usually a couple different paths that you could take, and it could depend on the patient of what to do. So that's what I do.
And then I'm going to say this at the end, but I wanted to jam in the beginning as well. Like, my audience can do what we did because we have a call to action with you guys. So they can basically get their labs done, which I strongly encourage everyone to do. And then they can set up a consult with you and go through and make any adjustments. And do you remember what that call to action was?
Yeah, we have our recommended lab panels posted on our website and a lot of various things as well. And yes, people can take these lab panels and lab markers and take them to their regular doctor and get them checked there. But most of the time, these specialty labs, for example, hormones or even vitamins, usually even vitamin D, you'll be charged about 10 times as much on average as what the wholesale price is. So we offer these at greatly discounted prices. There's a lot of other, you know, services that sell what we call self-service labs, where you can go to a website and get a panel. And usually the markers are not pertinent and they are much more expensive than what we offer. So we kind of do it as a public service. Again, it's not how we it's not our bread and butter. That's not how we feed our families. But we've gotten that question so often that we just post them there and people can go and order them.
Perfect. Yeah, I'll work with Cameron. I'll have a special link in the show notes, guys. And he set something up. Cameron's your assistant, and we'll get you guys. It's a little bit of a break, but it's just a kind of that extra motivation to do this. I know I thought about doing this for years, and then my good friend Josh Crawford reached out to you guys. Josh helps me with the Elk Shape training app and was like, hey, this guy's legit. They're going to do it for you. Go, and I had no more excuses, and let's dive in. So we'll go through Alicia's probably second. I want to give more time to hers. So maybe we can do kind of an overview of mine and then what you saw, what we decided to do, and then we'll move to Alicia's.
For sure. So yeah, high level of overview of yours. And again, I know we already kind of went through these a little bit, so maybe there's less surprises or whatnot. But at a high level, there's nothing that's extremely concerning. We saw a lot of changes that we often do in athletes, where if you go to your regular doctor, they start to get concerned with your liver or your kidneys because they see elevated things like CK, which is creatine kinase. That's just from broken down muscle. When you exercise, you break down muscle in order to synthesize. So, you know, you have to have muscle protein degradation and then compensatory muscle protein synthesis. A lot of times I say the average CrossFitter's CK is like 1,000. So yours was elevated and we'll check in the future. Occasionally patients just want to see that be a normal number, which is under about 400 or so. So I'll have them not exercise for 72 hours or so. And often it comes down significantly. You see this a lot in bodybuilders too. One of my really good friends is I don't know if he considers himself a bodybuilder, but he trains a lot and he has a lot of muscle mass. And a lot of times it's something like 2,000. That's not unusual to see. Although, you know, rhabdo does happen. Rhabdo is where CK is often, you know, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000. And the kidneys can't process it enough. It kind of rips through the filter of the kidney. And that is certainly concerning. So it's a good thing to check. But yeah, it's kind of a high level overview. Other things that are often altered is BUN and creatinine, or a BUN to creatinine ratio. You had high BUN, which is no surprise. You eat a lot of protein, and BUN is a breakdown product of protein. The better your retaining, people may have heard the term retaining nitrogen. For example, if you're naturally producing a lot of testosterone, or if you're on testosterone replacement or exogenous androgens in general, that's one of the things that helps with nitrogen retention. So blood urea nitrogen is one type of nitrogen that you're not retaining.
Yep. And then I know I wanted to dive into, I'm 42, the free testosterone and the differences and like your benchmark measurements in this blood lab and what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. So there's a concept, I call it androgen pool, and you're looking at your total testosterone, but total androgens in general. DHEA is very weak. DHT is stronger. But you look at SHBG, yours was 45, which is mid-range. In general, the more cardio you do and the less carbs you eat, your SHBG will increase. So it's very common to see, especially in ultra-endurance athletes or people who are really low carb or especially keto, really high SHBG and low free testosterone. So you kind of met that phenotype, but really your SHBG wasn't sky high. It's not unusual. I see 60 or even 90. A lot of times my SHBG runs around 60. So it kind of depends. If you have varicocele, which is basically varicose veins in the scrotum, about 25 to 30% of males do. But a lot of them just don't even know it because it's mild. And that's also another common reason why SHBG and FSH run high. We didn't see that in your case, but your insulin was 3.6. So you don't have insulin resistance, if people have heard of that. You're very metabolically healthy, which means SHBG also tends to run high. And the main downside of that in some people, especially males, as you mentioned, as they age in general, after the age of 30, total testosterone on average goes down by 10 per year, and free testosterone relative to that goes down even more. So fasting doesn't really matter for testosterone levels, but the time of the day certainly does. And I believe yours was done relatively early in the morning. Your LH was 3.5. That's the hormone that stimulates testosterone release. And your total was 471, and your free testosterone, both measured and calculated, were around 7. So, you know, technically normal for your age range, but if you were a few years younger, the range would be 9 to 26 instead of 6 to 21. And then after you're a few years older, again, moving target, the range will change again down to 5.0. So it's kind of a relative thing, given that the rest of your labs look much better than the average 42-year-old. You know, the average 42-year-old in this country has metabolic syndrome and dyslipidemia and insulin resistance. I'd say it's not that that's driving testosterone levels as they're decreasing, but you always have to keep in context what your baseline is. And if I remember right, I don't think you know a baseline from when you were like early 20s or anything.
I don't, which is a good point that if you are in your 20s, which my stats show that I got some of those that listen to this, go get a baseline and just bankroll it. You'll be very happy you did when you're in your 30s and your 40s. And if you can't, or if you can't measure it, it's tough to manage. Mm-hmm. Awesome. And then you also can green light to light me up a little bit on my cholesterol levels, which honestly, I remember getting a physical in my 30s and I had a nurse telling me to eat more avocados. Literally, I remember that plain as day. And I was like, I don't want to say what I thought, but I was just like pretty offended. I was like, you know what, my cholesterol, I don't know if I'd necessarily freak out about cholesterol levels, but you could school me otherwise. What was my total cholesterol? And I think it's 226.
Yeah, your total is 226. Your LDL is 150. And in general, if your LDL's above about 130, we go by ApoB, which is it's a particle. So actually LDL is technically a lipoprotein and not technically cholesterol, but I still call it cholesterol. But for the purist out there, we go by apolipoprotein B or ApoB. So anytime this comes back, I just put a tag that we check ApoB in the future. And we definitely want to keep that 90, below 90. It's an atherogenic particle, which means it causes atherosclerosis, which is basically just a type of plaque that can clog up coronaries or even clog up the arteries that lead to the genitals, cause ED in older age. It can clog up the arteries that are in the brain and cause a type of dementia called ischemic dementia. So a lot of times people will tell me, and you know, I'm probably guilty of thinking this when I was in my early 20s too, because I also genetically have very high cholesterol. I'm kind of in that like lean mass hyper responder phenotype, which I just did a podcast on. If shameless self-promotion of the Lean Mass Hyperresponder podcast that we did. But anyway, you know, it's, they'll say, well, I don't care about my cholesterol because maybe, you know, if I just want to live like a king and I don't want to have muscle aches or whatever else they think they're going to have if they address their cholesterol, and I want to eat when I want to eat. And if I have a heart attack or stroke when I'm 70, then no big deal. Except more often than not, it's not that you're dying from a heart attack or a stroke. You have a lot of morbidity, which is not when you, it's, you don't die, but you're just basically crippled, or you get dementia, or your quality of life is really severely affected even much earlier in life. LDL doesn't matter as much, but ApoB and LP little a definitely do. And there's a decently strong correlation between LDL and ApoB. The way that I think of it is the blocks that lead to plaque formation, but insulin resistance and inflammation is the glue. So if you're going to let your block count run high, it's really a bet against, well, how little glue do you really have? And there's a way to measure that. It's called a CCTA. You can do calcium scores if you're, you know, 65 or 70 plus, because it's had enough time to calcify. But if you're younger than that, then you really have to do a CCTA. Clearly Health is the service that we use. People can also go to our website and get those too. CLEERLY. But it'll tell you how much soft, invisible plaque that's there that would show up as zero on a calcium score. So it's not unusual. You know, even within the last couple of months, I've had a patient have a calcium score of zero and have a greater than 70% blockage in their LAD, which is one of the main coronary arteries. So there's a balance of this. I've also seen people with extremely high cholesterol that for a very long time have been very healthy, have low inflammatory markers like you did, and have a lifelong habit of good sleep, diet, and exercise, and they're very insulin sensitive, and they have little to no plaque. Although that being said, even newborn babies have a tiny bit of plaque. It's really just the clinically significant plaque that we're concerned about.
Awesome. So to circle back to the hot spot, the TRT gets brought up, and everyone's kind of talking about that these days. My testosterone number, the one that I thought you would talk about, was the 471. I thought I would be like maybe in the 600s or whatever, just the way that I feel about life. I jump out of bed, vigor and energy, vitality. I feel good, man. And then you didn't really talk about that number. You talked about the 7.5 number. Regardless, why didn't I qualify for TRT in your opinion?
Yeah, the main reason is there are some things that we can do that would potentially improve that number. The first one is just get a second level. I always like to get at least two levels. The next one is that your LH and FSH were a little bit lower than expected. So you look at cortisol. Cortisol didn't appear to be affecting you a ton, but perhaps a little bit. You look at estradiol, which is your main estrogen, and you see what's happening with that. You look at testicular health. You make sure that people aren't, you know, doing a jacuzzi or a hot tub every single day. You think about micronutrients. So sometimes I start taurine, which I believe we talked about. And then you look at vasodilation, you look at blood flow. So a lot of times you start a little bit of L-carnitine, or you start a little bit of creatine or tadalafil, something that helps with blood flow, which also has some evidence to increase testosterone naturally. But in between that first and that second testosterone level, I almost always try to improve things naturally in individuals who aren't deficient. Sometimes even in individuals that aren't deficient, because there's a lot of people that just don't want to start any medication, like let alone a hormone, and that's reasonable. And there's also definitely patients that come in, maybe they're in their 40s, 50s, whatever the age is, and they just like already know that they're having symptoms of low T, and they already want to start TRT even before their first test. It's actually pretty common to see this. Like the phenotype they usually are, they're usually like an athlete or a veteran that has had way better. The effort's not feeling as good. They want to maintain their health span. So what they really want is they want to maintain their performance and how they feel and their vigor and their energy and their focus and their motivation and just effort in all areas of life feeling good, not just in their athletic endeavors. And that is also my goal because it's their goal. And sometimes it includes TRT and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the levels come back surprisingly high. So that can happen. But there's definitely kind of like those two opposite ends of the spectrum. I feel like you have a very balanced approach and feeling to this. So that's why, if at all possible, I try to naturally improve things as much as possible. Because like let's say hypothetically, you did start TRT in another, like this alternate universe, and you didn't naturally optimize, then you had a side effect or wanted to come off for whatever reason. Because, you know, 99% of the time you can come off. I think of it as a lifetime commitment, because you would potentially want to do it for a lifetime, unless there's a reason to do it temporarily. Sometimes there is, but it's not like you're locked in for the lifetime. 99% of the time you come back to where you would be otherwise. So instead of that, then maybe we get your total testosterone to 550 and your free testosterone to 11, and you still start, but then you still know that you can get back to that number. And the other nice thing about that is a lot of times when that happens, you also start to feel better, and you can tell if it's correlated with how your testosterone is changing or not.
No, I was really pumped to get this done. It was definitely eye-opening. I had notes. The cool thing is after our consult, you sent me links into some of the things that I could take advantage of. I know L-carnitine was like high up on my priority list and a couple others. But I mean, all in all, what do you suggest for me to do as far as a follow-up, like 6 months, 1 year? When would I do this again?
Yeah, there's no specific time frame. I would say at minimum, getting a lab panel like this once a year makes a lot of sense. Since there's a lot of things that you're trying to optimize, often I have people get labs every 3 to 4 months as they're dialing things in, for lack of a better term, as they're improving things. And, you know, the general medical community or insurance company or, you know, most family doctors would probably say, well, all your labs were normal. So there's no reason whatsoever to come back within a year. But in reality, the spectrum or continuum of disease, health, and fitness is all one spectrum. So even if you're a healthier than average, you can still improve your fitness and make it less likely that you dip into a state of pathology. So if I was in your shoes, I'd get labs every 3 to 4 months.
Yeah. And I probably will, to be honest with you, especially this first year of doing it, and just see what's, I want to dial it in. You know, I really do. And then the annual thing is a no-brainer. Because I pushed it off for so long, and that's on me. And that's why I'm doing, putting myself out there just to hopefully encourage others to take control, you know, get measured. I was excited for Alicia. So I begged you guys to let Alicia in on this because she's quite the athlete. And we were just, I thought her blood work would be like, honestly, perfect because she is so healthy and eats clean and trains like a freaking animal, and is a super mom. So I wanted to give more time to going over her. She hasn't gone over these guys. We're doing this live. It's kind of embarrassing, but it's also, we're just keeping it real. So if there's anything we talk about that she doesn't want on the pod, I can edit it out. Here we go.
All right. That sounds good. And yeah, from a 1,000-foot view, Alicia, you kind of mentioned that when you got your labs back, there's a lot of things that you wanted to look up or that were concerning. And I'm the same way. So my wife calls me the world's biggest hypochondriac. So whenever I get my labs, like, oh no, I have to improve these things right away.
Oh, sorry to interrupt you. I think it's easy to do because they can all potentially correlate to one thing, and you get down these rabbit holes and, you know, like you're putting a puzzle together. So you're trying to figure out, you know, what's going on here, but it's best to leave it to the experts. So that's why I kind of stopped the Google and here we are.
For sure. But yeah, I guess from a 1,000-foot perspective, there weren't a ton of surprises with your labs. So they are kind of what I expected. You know, in a lot of high-level, high-performing female athletes, I have a lot of patients that are in that category. And occasionally I also give free lab panels, like a much smaller lab panels than the one you got, to the winner of some of the CrossFit competitions that the clinic sponsors from time to time. But it's always interesting to see. I have never seen a lab panel where there's not multiple things to improve and optimize. The same's the case in my labs and my wife's labs and whatnot. But it is interesting to see. See, at the top is carnitine. So carnitine's a dipeptide. You know, you eat plenty of meat, but carnitine has to be synthesized or put together from the two amino acids that it comes from, and your levels are normal. So that is pretty much as expected. Really, this is more of a sign of good absorption in the gut than anything else. You can increase your carnitine, especially if you're leaning more into cardio. I know a lot of triathletes do it. I know some people are saying that it's like the slippery slope, but really I see it kind of more of a alternative of creatine. Creatine is a tripeptide. So carnitine, creatine, taurine, those are kind of a decent three to where if you're using a lot of fuel, it makes sense to fuel your body. So creatine, I describe as a backup fuel tank. Carnitine is a fuel pump. If you're running a lot more fuel through your car, it makes sense to replace those things more often. Same thing as CoQ10. That's kind of like a fuel converting enzyme. That's actually one thing I don't think we checked in y'all's labs panels that fairly often I do add in athletes is I just like to check a CoQ10, especially if patients are on meds that alter their lipids. Usually you see the phenotype, people who have naturally low cholesterol, not like Dan and not like me, a lot of times they have lower CoQ10. So perhaps that's one of the advantages of having higher cholesterol levels. Next is vitamin D, and yours is 122. So I assume that you're supplementing.
Yeah, I've been supplementing for probably a year now.
Yeah, not a concerning level. It's fat soluble, so you can stockpile it. You could probably back off. And if you supplement 12 months of the year, you could probably just not supplement at all for the next couple months or not supplement over the summer and continue on otherwise.
She's outside all day, starting spring till the end of summer. And then we have the huge swings in daylight living in Washington. And so about a year ago, we noticed she needed to do something to elevate that level.
Well, mainly to elevate my mood.
You said it. I was going to say it.
Yeah. No, I've definitely been there too. You know, if you live north of roughly like if you can imagine the line between Oklahoma and Kansas, if you live north of about that latitude, then it can certainly help. But yeah, in your case, you could probably just supplement vitamin D in the winter. I do like combining vitamin D3 with K2.
Yeah, it's got that in there.
Yep. I use the Carlisle brand personally from Amazon. The soft gels, great deal, easy to absorb. My levels have generally come back great. So I'm obviously not like officially endorsing their company, but I recommend that a lot to people.
Okay.
Thyroid's good. Lipoprotein little A. It's a little over 100. This is about what mine started at as well. There's a couple things that can raise and lower this, but it's really common to see higher SHBG, higher lipoprotein little A. And then as your estrogen drops, so estrogen can help lower lipoprotein little A, but if it raises SHBG, it raises it. So it's kind of complicated. Think of LP little A as another lipid particle that previously helped, well, this is at least theoretical, helps blood clots form, so less postpartum hemorrhage. So our ancestors probably survived that had higher LP little A levels because they died less in childbirth, after childbirth specifically. But these days, it doesn't really, you know, play any beneficial role that we know of, other than tending to build up a little bit more plaque. You want to be below 75 or so. And it's in about 20 to 25% of people have elevated LP little A levels. There's a lot of types of LP little A, but the main takeaway is you're a little bit more aggressive seeing if there's plaque formation, and you're also more aggressive. And there's things that you can test, for example, to see if aspirin would help lower LP little A. There's a lot of different types or isoforms of LP little A and sizes of LP little A, but and there's no great way to test them at this point. The lower your testosterone, the lower your LP little A tends, the more increases. So testosterone can help decrease LP little A, estrogen can help decrease LP little A, aspirin and some people can help decrease LP little A, although it's kind of controversial whether it decreases heart attacks or whatnot. And then some medications called PCSK9 inhibitors can help decrease LP little A. Some statins might increase LP little A. So LP little A is kind of like a nice little fairly unknown thing. Mine also started out relatively high, but I also started out with super low estrogen. So as my estrogen, specifically estradiol levels have come up, my LP little A has been crushed from something like 100 down into 30s, which is really lower than I really need to have it. So there's a lot of things that we can do about this, but it's good to know. It's a test that everyone may as well order.
I mean, when I saw it, I'll be honest, I was like, oh my God, you know, it says values greater than 75 may be indicate an independent risk factor for CHD. And so, you know, I mean, when I'm seeing the normal value is less than 75 and I'm at 138, like that was alarming to me. But you're just like, oh, you know, it's a little high. Like, so it's not that bad is what you're saying? Or, I mean,
it's not unusual. Like pretty frequently I'll see 200s, 300s, 400s. And in those levels, it's more concerning because right now there's not a great way to get it under 75. I think we can get you under 100 for sure and probably under 75. But there's a bunch of new classes of medications. Amgen has one. Novartis has one. All these big drug companies have these medications that are going to affect the basically not let the LP little A lipoprotein develop. And those are going to decrease LP little A a whole lot. Right now, the most we can decrease it with any one intervention is 30%. So all the PCSK9 inhibitors, Repatha, Praluent, Leqvio is not a direct inhibitor, but it essentially inhibits the PCSK9 protein from being in the membrane. Basically, those lower it by about 30%. If you're lucky, aspirin can also lower it a little bit. And then nicotinamide riboside might lower it, but we don't know that for sure. There's no studies on it. That's just kind of extrapolating from niacin's data. People used to use niacin, which is a B vitamin, but there's a lot of flushing side effects in high doses. And there's been a lot of trials that don't show any beneficial cardiac outcome, and it can increase your blood glucose. Vitamin C or anything in general that can cause flushing might also lower it. I guess we don't have to like go too deep down the rabbit hole with LP little A, but yeah, the main takeaway is yours is a little bit high and there's definitely things that we can do to lower it. Even without this new class of medications. Fun fact, LP little A increases a lot during pregnancy. So does SHBG. CRP, that's your main inflammatory marker.
Easy.
What's that?
Oh, I'm just being a smart aleck.
We're done having kids. No.
yep, that was just the unrelated fun fact. Your CRP is 0.25. That means it's very low. You have extremely low levels of inflammation. So again, a lot less risk of heart disease. So you have a lot of these protective things, you know, the pesky lifestyle interventions like diet, exercise, sleep, they're going to be more powerful than any like random medication or supplement that we talk about.
Alicia's a professional sleeper. What I mean by that is she's getting 8 hours minimum, and that's like a minimum. And it's incredible. Like, you have to give her that. That's what she operates on. If you let her, she'll sleep 10. And always, that's not changed for the 15 years I've known her.
Only in the winter. I'll sleep like 8 in the summer. But
oh, okay.
Yeah, I hibernate in the winter.
How many hours of sleep do you get, Doc?
Usually about 7. Yeah, my wife, Maddie, usually goes to sleep a little bit before me and then wakes up an hour or two after me. So she's also a professional sleeper.
Yeah.
Great. Like Matt Walker says, it's a superpower. So yeah, next up on the list is SHBG. I love talking about SHBG. It's sex hormone binding globulin, binds up all your androgens and estrogens. So binds up things like testosterone, estradiol, which we'll talk about next, which is normal. So in general, you don't want this to be too high because then you'll have lower free androgens. You don't want it to be too low because then you'll be more sensitive to androgens. So you'll have like masculinization symptoms and then just more hormone fluctuations because they're metabolized very quickly. So a lot of people with hormone instability, it's actually just SHBG instability. Best two things that you can do to raise your SHBG, whether you're a male or a female, is exercise more, especially cardio, eat less carbs and calories in general. So yours is perfect. Next is estradiol, 81. I assume you were luteal phase around day, 20, early 20s for these labs?
I couldn't tell you because I have an IUD.
Okay, so you probably were. Your estradiol is normal and healthy. IUDs have a type of synthetic progestin in it, unless it's a Paragard. Is it copper?
No.
So Mirena, Kylina, Skyla, they have a type of synthetic progestin in it. And it's actually derived from 19-nor testosterone, but not that that matters particularly. A tiny bit of it goes systemic. It's possible that your estradiol would have, more spikes and drops if you do not currently have one. But from the looks of it, you're probably a later cycle. So probably luteal phase based off your progesterone. So this makes sense that your estradiol Like if you just look at it, it looks like a follicular phase estradiol, which is the first half of the cycle. And, but yeah, now that with the context of the rain air or whatnot, it looks like it's luteal and it's perfectly fine. Next is your thyroid. All your thyroid labs are fantastic. Next is your B12 and folate, which are kind of interesting. Your folate's high, which is great. Your B12 is 613, which is normal, but your MCV is a touch higher than you would expect, but your homocysteine is normal. So homocysteine, if that's high, if people have listened to, you know, a lot of functional health doctors or whatnot, they talk about MTHFR and how they need methylated B vitamins and whatnot. That's kind of what it's talking about. Because your MCV is slightly high, that's your average red blood cell size. It's 97, technically normal, but very high normal. It would be reasonable to add in more B12, but you're also consuming plenty of B12. There's a lot of B12 in meat. So in general, unless you're vegetarian, you're consuming plenty, but it's absorbed in the very last part of the small intestine called the terminal ileum. You're activating it well too. So it's a little strange that your MCV is high. Hypothyroidism can be another cause of that, but your thyroid was perfect. So really, I don't see a reason why your MCV is high. I think we checked a reticulocyte count, which was normal. I think it was 1.8, if I remember. Or maybe we didn't on your lab. So that'd be one thing that we can check is a reticulocyte count, which is a baby red blood cell count. Mm-hmm. There's something called a female athlete's triad, which is kind of hard to see in your case because with an IUD, no menses, then you don't lose as much blood. And that's likely one of the reasons why we see the elevated ferritin and elevated iron saturation. With your B12, you may as well add in more of a lozenge. That way it skips. And you're not on any acid blockers or Pepcid or pantoprazole. So that way it skips the absorption of the gut. It doesn't have to go through that mechanism. And it might allow you to have a bit more hemoglobin, a bit more red blood cells, and a bit more oxygen carrying capacity.
That's interesting because, okay, so I'll just tell you, when I looked at these labs, what I kept seeing was like hemocytosis because of the elevated ferritin and the elevated iron. And then I was like, well, the treatment for that is essentially, for lack of a better term, like bloodletting and or donating. And, but I was like, I couldn't do that because my hemoglobin's not that high. So, you know, do you see any indication of that being with the elevated ferritin and the elevated iron and the total iron binding capacity? I just saw those three things and I was like, ooh, like kind of worried me.
Yeah. You probably have a couple of genes. I have two of the six main SNPs. So there's kind of like a couple different genetic terms that I'll define. One is wild type. So that's your reference genome. One is a SNP, a single nucleotide polymorphism. It's not really a mutation, which is a rare difference in the genome. It's a very common difference. And with Caucasians, again, common differences are very common. Less women died in childbirth. Because remember, you know, before we had modern medicine, 1% or so of females died every time that they had a child. So if that happened when they had their first or second child, and then the ones that had a little bit of extra iron, they had some hemochromatosis SNPs, like you and I probably do. They had more iron reserve, so they didn't bleed out as much and they died less. And then they had 12 kids instead. So the multiplying effect, just like the Idiocracy movie, just more and more. So it's very common. I think it's something like 25% of Caucasians have at least one of the hereditary hemochromatosis genes. It's just not super clinically penetrant. And people who have a whole bunch of genes, usually your iron saturation is greater than 90%. So yours was only in the 70s. I think mine's usually in the 50s or so. And one of the best ways to get rid of excess iron or ferritin is just to make more red blood cells. So in your case, I'd rather make more red blood cells and then worry about donating blood if your ferritin's still high.
So I can get on EPO then?
Well, probably don't need EPO for that. A little methyl B12, that'd help. And, you know, looking at your energy.
Who's the fighter who just got busted a year ago for EPO?
There's a whole bunch of them. I know one of the.
Dylan Shaw.
Yeah, that's right.
He totally, and he denied it. And then he finally came clean. And it was because he was trying to win a belt in like the lightest weight. And he looked terrible cutting down. And he was like, he didn't tell his coaches or anybody. He just got on it. And they, USADA flagged that so fast, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sad. My favorite way to increase erythropoietin is to increase androgen status. So, okay. You know, your and your free testosterone assay, we haven't really talked about your testosterone yet. Right. Your free testosterone said 2 point something, but your SHBG was about 60. And your total testosterone, I believe, was 18 or 16. It was something like that. I'll find it in a second. But basically, your free testosterone, if you calculate it, it'll come back at 1 or even lower than 1. So your free testosterone is really not that high. And testosterone levels are going to be somewhat suppressed, depending on the person, when you have an IUD. So if you look at your LH and FSH, those drive testosterone released from the theca cells, which are cells in the ovary. And then if you look at your DHEA sulfate, those are going to drive, your LH was 5.2, your FSH was 2.7. And then your total was 16. DHEA sulfate in your case was 186. So most of your testosterone appears to be adrenally produced. So, you know, let's say you took your IUD out for whatever reason, your total testosterone would probably go up to something like 40. So it's reasonable to replace it to that amount. Another thing that is more common is a lot of women take a supplement called DHEA. It's technically a bioidentical hormone. It's dehydroepiandrosterone. The downside to it is it converts to 5-androstenedione and also converts to DHT eventually down the line. So it's not uncommon to have a little bit of hair shedding, but especially common to have acne and oily skin when you're on a lot of DHEA. Not as common if you're on other exogenous hormones like exogenous progestin. And IUDs are basically just a touch of exogenous progestin that goes systemic. So that's something that a lot of individuals would do. In general, if people are not trying to become pregnant in the foreseeable future, you can shift that ratio of the DHEA supplement with something like a once a week or once every 2 weeks capsule of dutasteride, which alters enzymes. But usually in cases like this, when everything is normal, unless there's a reason to jump to that, I normally don't. And again, we could talk about testosterone and SHBG and the conversion of other androgens like DHEA to both estrogen and testosterone for quite some time. Sometimes I'll go with a more natural strategy, which is what I was actually going to recommend in your case, something called D-chiroinositol. It's a type of inositol. People used to call it vitamin B8. And you can take it, and it increases adrenal production of DHEA even more. A lot of times I'd like to combine this with Vitex, which helps with the conversion to estrogen, because it can also convert to estrogen. We wouldn't want it to cause like spotting or whatnot, although at your age, it wouldn't be that concerning. But it also helps control prolactin. So prolactin and dopamine kind of have a tug of war. So I like to combine those two things along with a supplement called Tonkat, which increases the steroidogenesis cascade in general at a couple different steps, and see how you respond, and kind of hope that both your DHEA and your testosterone would get a little bit of a bump from those things, and see how it goes.
Yeah, he recommended Tonkat for me. I forgot about that.
And for me as well. So to kind of put this in more general terms, like what would all of that, like what kind of benefits could I expect to see from adding those in potentially?
Slightly better cardio, effort feeling a little bit better. Yeah. Some people find DHEA to provide a neurosteroid benefit, as it is technically a sigma-1 receptor agonist. That's, people have heard of the vagus nerve, or they do like vagal maneuvers or vagal tone. It might help with that parasympathetic rest and digest tone. People with OCD or ADHD symptoms often find a benefit from it. DHEA, in addition to like ginkgo biloba, can do similar things. But your DHEA was not low to start, so I don't feel like you're as likely to get that benefit. Mostly the benefit would come in what it converts to. So it converts to other androgens like testosterone. So you get more signaling at the androgen receptor. Whatever progestin is going systemic, of note, is also weakly binding the androgen receptor. So any of the 19 of, I think they're fourth generation, they're either third or fourth generation progestins. So there's five main classes of hormonal birth control, which really I kind of see as HRT. It's just not bioidentical HRT because you're replacing progestin, but it does bind the androgen receptor weakly. But the good thing is, since it's an IUD, it's a pretty clinically insignificant effect in a lot of tissues. But basically, you want to restore that natural balance to some degree. There's a physician who's now passed away in Canada that pushed very hard to combine DHEA with a whole bunch of different types of hormones that are used in contraceptives.
Now, would that increase like mood changes? Because since I've had the IUD, it's like I'm like steady Eddie compared to what I was prior. So would adding in something like DHEA cause more mood swings potentially?
Within reason, it shouldn't. A lot of the mood swings come from the progestin side of things. So it can spike your estrogen and perhaps cause you to be like a little bit more tearful. For example, some people say before they, and not as much with IUDs, but definitely with oral contraceptives, that they used to like cry more during sad movies or cry more during not sad movies, just at certain times of the cycle, just have like random huge spikes of emotion. And DHEA, and a lot of the times it's estrogen driven. If you're on a whole bunch of DHEA, and that can do it, usually I limit it to 10 milligrams, sometimes up to 25 in some females. But if a female takes 100 mgs, then that can certainly downstream convert to estrogen and drive some of that. And it can also convert to androgens. So it's more often than not, you see skin symptoms in females that take too high of a dose of DHEA. But yeah, starting at a dose of 10 milligrams of micronized DHEA, probably not. It does convert to stronger androgens that act in the prefrontal cortex. So that's more of like the roid ragey, for lack of a better term. That's just when your androgenic drive, which usually doesn't spike at a huge amount during the cycle, but it can spike around mid-cycle, where you just feel like you need to move things or you have that physical energy. Sometimes things can be skewed too far that way. That's usually just when you're converting a whole bunch to DHT.
Wow. So the listeners that are like, I don't know anything these guys just said for the last 45 minutes. I understand that. But what the point of all this is, for me, I wanted to be like transparent and almost like have that encourage other people to take that step, because if they're like me, man, I'm not excited to go get a physical and have some dude tell me to turn my head and cough. Like, that's like the worst part. I remember in high school getting physicals. I got maybe one physical in my 20s. I didn't get a physical in my 30s. It's like, this is stupid. I'm not getting a physical. But my audience, there's some guys, especially in their 40s and 50s, that have never had this done. And I wanted Alisha on here to show even the ladies, you know, if you're taking your health and your longevity and your trajectory as serious as we are, this is the stuff you have to go get your oil changed and checked and analyzed. So I guess my whole point of this conversation, Doc, is like, what are maybe like five reasons why everybody on planet Earth should get their labs done and run it with you?
Yeah. At the end of the day, God put us here in these organic machines. And as of now, we haven't figured out a way to rehab or replace our machines as much as we would like. Yeah, there's hip replacements and knee replacements. But and yes, there's coronary artery bypasses. But really, if you had one car that you wanted to last 90 years or even 100 years, yeah, you would be very sure to rotate the tires and change the oil, like you said, and you would be spot on us preventive maintenance. And that's how I think we should be as good stewards of the bodies that we have. You know, some people are dealt different hands, and figuring out what that is earlier. Yes, it can bring some stress and anxiety initially, but maybe it helps people, like, you know, find their metaphysical self, and they find, you know, a purpose beyond living in a physical life, or even brings up topics of maybe there is purpose beyond, you know, just being hairless apes here. So there's a lot of positives and negatives. A lot of it's how you look at it. Is it glass half full? Is it glass half empty? Is it glass quarter full? Is it glass three quarters empty if you're in a state of illness? So that's kind of the way that I see the like high arching like body, mind, soul. Why should we care about our physical bodies? You're just being vain, et cetera, et cetera. Past that, the next reason would be there's a lot that we can do about it. So for example, a lot of people genetically have high cholesterol. And if your inflammatory markers are low and you're not insulin resistant and you don't have a lot of plaque in your coronaries, then that's a completely different situation than if there's somebody that has the same exact cholesterol that's not in that situation. So it's much easier to figure that out when you're, you know, in your 30s or 40s than when you're in your 50s or 60s, but it's never too late. So that would be my second call to action. And then the third call to action is what I mentioned earlier. It'd be your state of illness and then your state of health and your state of fitness. And the closer you are to fitness, the slower it will be to get to illness. Just like when you're investing in your 401k or whatnot, the closer you are to having a huge retirement account, the longer and longer it will take for that retirement account to be depleted. It's just it's your physical retirement account in your own body that's prolonging your health span. Yes, the average life expectancy is now slightly starting to decrease in the United States and in developed countries in general. But that's really not the concerning thing. The concerning thing is that more people are getting neurodegenerative disease and more people are alive, but with very low quality of life. And we do have an aging population. So the investment that you make in your body by getting these baseline labs will pay dividends for many years and lead to, if nothing else, a lot of quality of life.
Yeah, my biggest takeaway has been like, no, you haven't been dealt as set, you know, cards. This is your hand. This is all you can, like, literally balls in your court. Like, every little thing you eat, your training, your stress levels, like the holistic approach, like a lot of control is available to you if you can at least do some diagnostics and figure out, you know, what tweaks to make. And people probably don't know this about you, man, but like you run in a pretty cool circle of people that I'm going to brag for you. Like Humerman, you and him are homeboys. Like you guys have shared content. Tell us a little bit about your circle of friends and peers that you run with, because you're not going to brag about you, but I will.
Well, thank you. I'm very blessed to have a lot of friends in the industry. I actually got into doing podcasts via my friend Derek, who has the More Plates, More Dates YouTube channel. And I used to chat with him via various methods or whatnot, and we share cases. And I started a different clinic with him and a different lab service and whatnot. And we're still good friends, and I'm sure we'll do a lot together in the future. But the way that I started doing podcasts is he suggested it to the Mark Bell podcast. So I did that, and Huberman listened, and he's kind of been kind of a mentor to me since then. Because at the end of the day, I'm just doing this for the same reason why Dr. Huberman does his podcast, for high quality, scientific and clinical information to the public, free of cost. And it's a very efficient way to do things. A lot of the things that I explain are what I would talk to, you know, is that I use the same phrases that I've talked to patients about for years. So it's a way to tell thousands of people the same thing instead of just one at one time. And then past that, not to be annoying to people that, don't have a faith or whatnot, but I see a lot of my life goal or whatnot in helping people be healthy with their physical bodies and relating that to, you know, keeping your body as a temple, and you want to be a good steward of what you've been given. When I was in my earlier 30s, I thought to myself, you know, it's probably time. I had an extremely high cholesterol level come back on a screening. And anyways, I was like, yeah, probably time that I look into things, because I knew I had varicose veins. And I was newly married, and I knew that I wanted to have kids as well. A lot of people ask why I got into it. This is part of the reason. Even before that, I knew I wanted to do full spectrum medicine and whatnot. But, you know, some people ask, well, why are you into it the same way as Brian Johnson, the Blueprint guy, who's all over the YouTube and news and whatnot? Because he's like, you know, screw dying, F dying, and we want to live forever and this and that. And I don't know if I'm exactly the same. I kind of got into health optimization, but from a completely opposite convergent way. And yeah, I got an ultrasound, long story short, both of my testes had atrophied, and it wasn't super surprising because I knew I had varicose veins that were getting worse and worse. And I felt fine at the time. My estrogen was extremely low, but my lipoprotein little A was super high. My ApoB was really high. And in general, like, I just was not in a good state of health, despite having a pretty good lifestyle. And, you know, eventually I naturally optimized things as much as I could. I ended up starting HCG. And even without the HCG, I did have children. And, you know, my fertility is always kind of something that I'm constantly keeping in check. So in general, I'm off and on HCG from time to time, which basically just stimulates more natural endogenous testosterone production and sperm production too. And also just keeps things from atrophying too much. So there's definitely a difference between starting then. If I had done nothing for 10 years, I probably would have had more plaque in my coronaries, more plaque in my brain, but have been much less healthy. I would have had more body fat. Yes, I would have had less muscle mass. Effort would not have felt quite as good. Maybe I would have gone through infertility for a period of time too. So there's a lot of positives to that. So I'm very glad that I did it. But at the same time, I don't feel like, you know, some people would consider me overly aggressive. That's just my perspective. I think it's an easy decision of when you should start to intervene for preventive health. It's also possible that I would have checked everything and I would have found nothing at all. But you don't know if you don't check.
Mm-hmm. Mic drop right there. Do you have anything else for the doc?
No, I really appreciate you going through these things. And I feel like I got some good takeaways. And I look forward to kind of getting a summary of what we've discussed and potentially how I can optimize, you know, my labs and my life.
For sure. Yeah. Happy to help.
Yeah. That's what I got, guys. Was about a week later, I got an email from his clinic, just kind of spelling out what we consulted on and then some links to some certain things that I could get and take advantage of. And then I think we'll just do it again probably in about 6 months and see where we're at and if we made any adjustments. Same with Alicia. And again, there will be a call to action in the show notes. I'm working with Cameron, your assistant guy, who will help us get an active link that will give you guys a small discount and then that you will get your blood. It's easy. Like, you'll have several options where you live where you can just, on your own time, go fasted. Head over, make an appointment, get your blood drawn. They'll take about, what, six or seven little vials of blood, yeah. And you're done. And then it takes, you know, you'll have your appointment after they get the results and you'll go through it like we just did here. And some of the stuff you will be over your head, but you just ask questions and then get a snapshot. It makes a lot of sense to me. And I appreciate your time today, Doc.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for giving me the platform and for the promotion and questions and whatnot. And also thank you for being open with whatever your health journeys are as well. I hope that it helps a lot of people.
Awesome. Appreciate your time. Guys, remember, separation is in the preparation. We'll catch you on the next one. Wow. Okay. He said so much stuff. Luckily you're a nurse and you're kind of have reps at like dumbing down what the doctor says. The guy's extremely brilliant, right?
He's so smart and he's got so much information in your brain. And I can totally relate to that. You know, having the science background, and a lot of times it's, you get stuck in the weeds a little bit trying to explain all of the nitty gritty details, but I think it'd be good to just kind of talk about what were our takeaways from speaking with the doctor and how we can use what he said to help improve our labs and improve our health and longevity.
Yeah. So for like the guys listening, like everybody wants to know what's their testosterone level. And I did too. Like, but I did tell you before I got my test, I'm like, I don't feel like I got low T, babe. Like, I literally jump out of bed every day excited. I don't have a lot of mood swings. I train really hard. and I just feel like I always have felt. And then I got my work back and it was like, you know, you're borderline is basically what his takeaway is. You could try a couple things here or there, but really it would have been better if you had baselines 10 years ago, 20 years ago, which we don't. So I'm encouraging the young guys out there, hey man, get your baseline and then just save your paperwork, maybe upload it to a cloud and then revisit in 10 years. But for those that are older than me, you definitely got to get that stuff checked, man, because your T levels, your free testosterone, and he didn't really care about like the big number, like the I wasn't even 500. It was like under 500. The number he gave was the 7 and he thought I should be more in the 9 to 12, but
that's the free testosterone that he was seemed more concerned about.
Yeah, and honestly, it didn't seem like he's like is doesn't look like it's any trouble for you right now, you know. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna buy that because I am recovering pretty fast. I mean, not as fast as I used to. I have more aches and pains, but I just chalk that up to aging. But I'm still my training bouts are extremely fruitful. They're intense. My strength is still going up from post elk season, and all in all, I'm pretty happy with I don't know what he had to tell me. Like the two biggest things he said was the Tomcat, which has to do with like iron, and then the L-carnitine, just for helping like your metabolic health. But all in all, I was pleased to see my vitamin D was good, my B12 was good. That all, my cholesterol was a little high, but you know, I wasn't susceptible to being insulin resistant. And you know, I loved his analogy about, yes, that's a kind of a red flag, the higher cholesterol, 226, but the glue is very low in your body. And the glue being, do you remember what he said? It was the glue was your inflammation.
Yes. And that was low. The C-reactive protein.
And so I'm like, okay, if my glue's low, then the total cholesterol I know was in the 200s 10 years ago. And I had a nurse literally telling me, you should try eating more avocados. And I was just like, listen, B, I eat avocados every day. Anyways, I do supplement with the fish oil. I think that's highly been. I just was so pumped about my lab work because I've been taking religiously a multivitamin 3 times a day, getting fish oil from Wilderness Athlete. I take a joint support. I do take post-workout creatine and BCAAs. I eat a buttload of elk meat, as you guys could probably guess, like literally elk every day. So it was interesting to just kind of get this. I would encourage you to find out your total cholesterol, to find out if you're insulin resistant. Make sure that your thyroid levels, because that can mess your metabolism up for good.
Absolutely.
And then just the T levels is nice to know. On the lady's side, I was blown away. Like, we got your blood work back and we didn't get a chance to talk to him for a week. And I would say like there was a week of you Googling everything and you were thinking something was wrong with you.
Well, right. So despite being a nurse, you know, even with what Dr. Gillette mentioned in his podcast, I mean, I would say if you know, 90% went over your head, I would say, you know, 80% went over mine, because he has so much in-depth knowledge of all of those labs. But the important thing is, I think kind of what I took away from this is the big picture. Okay.
Yes.
I'm asymptomatic on whatever those labs showed. Okay. So I had, you know, high iron and high ferritin, and I'm looking at this and making up my own diagnosis. But the bottom line is like stopping for a moment and looking at, how do I feel? How is my sleep? How is my performance in the gym? How is my recovery? And knowing that, you know, what I'm eating is very clean, and my energy levels are high and whatnot. So my point is, I think, look at your symptoms, look at anything that may be kind of, you know, bothering you, or, you know, that you notice, maybe a sign of not good health. And, you know, maybe that's your reason for going to get your labs. But as Dan mentioned, maybe it's to get a baseline. Like, you have to start somewhere. And if you don't have labs from before, like, get them now. And then I'm definitely going to be much less concerned 6 months down the road when I go to get my labs, because I've already spoken with the doctor and kind of gone over some things that I know that can help improve. So it's just, you know, one step at a time. And I think that having these labs done is just going to give you such a good indication of where you're at, where you can improve, and, you know, you control what you can control.
Yeah, the biggest takeaway of this podcast, in my opinion, is like, I think he said it pretty well, is like, you know, life expectancy, longevity. I mean, people are living longer until maybe recently a little, but what kind of like quality of life in the back end of your life? Like you and I, I'm 42. You're 37?
37.
Okay. And I thought maybe I'd want to like retire when I'm 60. Ish, which is kind of funny to like say that out loud because the idea of me retiring is pretty laughable, correct?
Well, and I'm actually 38. I don't know how old I am. You're 38. Yeah, I mean, I don't really see you ever not doing what you do because you love what you do.
I do what I love, but you know, motion is lotion for the body and staying active. And the last thing I want to do is set myself up to be able to retire. And then when I finally do retire, my final chapters in life is at an old person's home where I don't have a good quality of life. I'm not there cognitively, and it's just a downward spiral. So I'm just pushing so hard now to try to like get in front and have, I just want to elk hunt when I'm in my 80s.
It's not about living to be 100.
No.
It's about having quality of life in those later years. And I mean, I can't emphasize that enough with just the experience that I had working in the hospital on the stroke unit for 10 years. It was just devastating. And, you know, I mean, so many of the things that I saw were preventable through lifestyle factors and things that is 100% in your control. Now, I'm not saying everything will prevent, you know, there are things that can happen and genetic factors certainly that take, you know, have a place there. But to have that quality of life later on in your years is probably the most important thing, right?
Yeah. When we're all so busy just trying to make a living and everyday stress, like control the controllables. Mm-hmm. You can't control your genetic disposition, your hereditary, but you can make changes now that will benefit you down the road. And if you don't know what controllables that you need to control, you're in trouble. So go get your blood work done, guys. Check out the link below. We make $0 off this. We wanted to give back to our audience. We appreciate your support. This is season 7. Separation is in the preparation. Go get that measured so you can manage it. Appreciate you guys. We'll catch you on the next one.